Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the collapse of Yemen, a country on the front line of the war on terror that only recently senior national security officials were claiming was a success story in the battle against al-Qaeda. Christopher Swift, a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia's Center on National Security Law, joins us to discuss the dire warning the UN Secretary General gave to the UN Security Council that, quoting, "Yemen is collapsing before our eyes," and the capture of an army base by al-Qaeda, where militants are now in possession of a lot of heavy weaponry. Then we'll examine Congress's plans to cut food stamps again and the apparent compulsion among Republican lawmakers to punish the working poor by demanding that recipients are drug tested and should be required to show a photo ID when they use their government-issued debit card to buy food for their families. Jim Weil, president of the Food Research and Action Center, joins us to discuss this second attempt after Republicans tried to cut $40 billion from the program in 2013 but managed to strip $8 billion, and the false assumption that food stamp recipients are freeloaders when half are children and 43% live in households where someone is earning. Then finally, we will speak with a veteran CIA officer, Robert Grenier, who was the CIA station chief in Islamabad and the head of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. He's the author of the new book, just out, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA Diary. And we will discuss what went wrong in Afghanistan after the successful routing of the Taliban and al-Qaeda in the first Afghan war, based on war plans that Robert Grenier drafted, and his refusal to sustain White House interrogation policies that led to him being forced out of the Counterterrorism Center. And joining us now is Christopher Swift, who is a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia's Center for National Security Law. His forthcoming book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Swift.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And the UN Secretary General is warning. In fact, he told the Security Council that Yemen is collapsing before our eyes. We cannot stand by and watch. What indeed can we do, do you think, Christopher?
Well, one of the things the United States can do straight away is to start identifying and sanctioning people who've been supporting the uprising in Sana'a. That includes the former president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who, despite fighting three wars against the Houthi rebels who've sort of destabilized the government there, has now formed a secret alliance with them to destabilize the government. Sanctioning Saleh and his family and his supporters would go a long way to pulling some of the economic energy out of that particular movement. And then some of the other things that the United States can do are work very closely with our allies in the region to get people talking again. Yemeni culture is very focused on wheeling and dealing. It's a trading culture. People spend hours and hours a day sort of talking about politics and making deals and setting up businesses. And it's a very mercantile society. The political system's very similar. And, you know, if you look at ordinary Yemenis in the streets, they'd much rather be talking than fighting.
But Saleh is a sort of proxy or a stalking horse or whatever we want to describe him as for the Saudis, isn't he? So it would seem that these secret negotiations that Saleh had with the Houthis, if the Saudis weren't conducting them, they're certainly watching them.
Yeah, I wouldn't call him a stalking horse for the Saudis. I think if he's a stalking horse for anyone, he's a stalking horse for his oldest son, who he'd like to see succeed in the presidency. Look, one of the difficulties is there are a number of different external actors that would like to have some influence in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is one of them. Iran is another. The United States and the European Union are others. But at the end of the day, what's going on in Yemen is driven by endogenous rather than exogenous phenomena, by stuff that's happening inside the society and not pressures and influences from outside. And the outside influences can sort of push things a little bit in one way or the other, but it doesn't change the fundamental dynamics in Yemen. And those are driven by things like resource constraints, competition among tribal and political and ideological factions, and the fact that you have, you know, a population that's going to double by 2025 and a water table that's going to fall through the floor before then.
But you also have this odd contrast, do you, in contrast to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is one of the richest countries in the world per capita, and it borders on Yemen, which is one of the poorest countries in the world per capita.
That's right. That's right. And it's something that one of the things that the Saudis are very concerned about is large movements of Yemenis into Saudi territory as the political situation, the economic situation, but also the ecological situation in Yemen collapses. And in many ways, the sort of instability and insecurity we're seeing with all the different factions defecting from a political process and turning to violence in the streets is emblematic of the broader economic and ecological decay that we're also seeing in Yemen. And, you know, all of these factors contribute one to the other.
And again, I'm speaking with Christopher Swift, who's a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia's Center for National Security Law. His forthcoming book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. I had heard a scenario put forth by some people at the Carnegie Center in Beirut suggesting that Saleh's sort of secret negotiations with the Houthi to take over the country, or at least the north of the country, but they've clearly moved further south than that. Was some kind of there's a possible subtext or a deal in that where there could be a subsequent division of the country, going back to what it was, north and south Yemen, with the Houthis in charge of the north and a sort of Saudi-friendly government in the south, the notion being that because those oil terminals and facilities are there, that somehow the Saudis could find a way to get their oil directly to the Indian Ocean, to their Asian customers, and bypass the Gulf. Have you heard anything along those lines?
Yeah, that sounds rather fanciful to me, in part because the majority of the oil and gas production in Yemen is in a town called Marib, which is in the northern part of the country. And yes, there are good ports and terminals in the south, but if you don't have control of the pipelines leading from Marib to the points of discharge, then it just doesn't make sense. Look, what I can tell you that is true about Yemen and about Yemeni politics is you have many different factions, whether it's the Houthi in the north or Harak, the socialist secessionist movement in the south, whether it's the Joint Meetings Party, which is sort of a coalition of opposition groups, or whether it's Saleh's old party, whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's some other organization, would be like a tribal confederation, all of these different factions are fighting over a shrinking economic pie. And they're all trying to get a larger slice of that economic pie for their own groups, their own followers. Yemen's a patronage-driven society. And traditionally, when people would sort of use Yemen as an access point to get up into the Arabian Peninsula or to connect, you know, the Indian Ocean with the Red Sea across land, you know, local tribal leaders were able to tax, you know, various products and things as they came through their territory. Then once we had industrialization, you had the energy boom across the Middle East, the government temporarily centralized and then tried to give out oil wealth as a way to replace that traditional patronage. Well, one of the things that's happened is the oil has gone away, is the patronage has gone away, and it's made it much harder for traditional social institutions, be they tribal or otherwise, to sort of hold the country together. And the competition you're seeing on the streets of Sana'a, Yemen's capital today, is a result of all of these groups fighting for a larger piece of a shrinking pie.
But the U.S.
That's a domestic process, not an international one.
But in terms of an international focus, particularly the United States, our focus is, of course, is on Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And Al-Qaeda just took a large army base in Shabwa province, reportedly a home to more than 1,000 troops, and they captured heavy weaponry. So what does this say for U.S. policy? I recall it wasn't that long ago that John Brennan, the head of the CIA, was talking about how well things were going in Yemen for the United States.
Well, one of the difficulties that we have here in Washington is our national security establishment has a remarkable tendency to speak to national security establishments in foreign countries. Usually the story they get is that they need more money, but things are going terribly well. One of the flaws we've had in sort of the last 3 or 4 or 5 years of U.S. policy in Yemen has been that over-reliance on elites in the national capital, rather than really getting out into the field and understanding what's happening to local tribal leaders, local business leaders, local community leaders in the places where Al-Qaeda operates, in the places where it recruits. Look, Ian, what happened between 2012 and 2014 looked very much like we were doing well against al-Qaeda. We pushed al-Qaeda out of two southern provinces in the south, in Shabwa province, the province where they're primarily operating now. We pushed them up into the mountains. They went to ground. They dug into the local civilian population. They were involved in a lot of low-level operations, but nothing like the large-level conventional kinds of warfare we saw from them in the 2012 period. Now that there is no Yemeni government to check them, now that there's constant turmoil over who's in charge and who's, you know, who's paying the soldiers and what chain of command to follow, it's not surprising to me in the least that al-Qaeda would step into that vacuum and try to exercise their leverage and try to take as much as they possibly can. But again, that's not a product of a failure of U.S. policy. It's a product of changing conditions on the ground that outsiders really can't control, because at the end of the day, Yemenis are the ones who are making decisions about the future of their own society.
Well, much of the coverage, of course, in our press refers to the Houthis as Shia, and they are, of course, a branch of Shiism. And also, the assumption is that they are, you know, controlled by Iran, which I understand is not necessarily the case.
No, it's a very primitive understanding of what's happening there.
Well, give us a more sophisticated one then.
Sure, if I can. Look, when you're looking at Shia Islam, one of the things that you need to do is sort of understand the point at which that particular sect of Shia Islam broke off from the Sunni branch, broke off from the Sunni trunk. And the Zaydis, where the Fiver Shias were the first to depart from you know, the Sunni core. They're very Sunni in terms of their outlook, in terms of the way they pray, in terms of their theology. They just recognize another imam. And so if you look to the Alawis in Syria, you know, that's Bashar al-Assad's particular religious group. They have some additional imams that you follow. And then if you go to Iran, you have the Twelvers, and they have a whole 12 series of imams that they follow and sort of wrap up around their particular theology. The Zaydis and the tensions between the Zaydis and the Sunnis were non-existent, by and large, until the Houthi rebels tried to turn religion into a basis for mobilizing people over what was fundamentally an effort to gain greater autonomy and an effort to gain access to more economic resources. And in the process of doing that, they looked to the outside world to get whatever resources they could to pursue their internal objectives. One of the places where they were able to get resources was from Hezbollah in Lebanon. If you look at Houthi propaganda, it is exactly Hezbollah propaganda. They'll say death to America, death to Israel, death to the Jews. Most of these people couldn't find America on a map, have a vague sense of where Israel is, and have never met a Jew. In terms of the Iranian influence, yes, there's been Iranian money going in to support the Houthis, again, mainly through Lebanon and the Hezbollah vector. And there have also been some attempts to ship arms to the Houthis from Iran or through Iran's proxies, many of which have been intercepted. But if you look at what the Houthis are doing on a day-to-day basis, they're not following what either Hezbollah or Iran wants them to do. What they're doing is expropriating those external resources, telling people whatever they want to hear, and then going and doing whatever they choose to do in their own society. And that's a model that should be very familiar to us after 13, 14 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq.
But surely, though, they have no love for al-Qaeda.
Absolutely not. No. They've been fighting one another up in the northern provinces on and off again for several years. I mean, look, back in 2010, 2011, Nasser al-Wahishi, the leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, wrote an article where he basically said, you know, we can do business with the Houthis. The Zaydis are not that much different from the Sunnis. At the end of the day, we have a common enemy, and that's Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was at the time the president of Yemen. As soon as Ali Abdullah Saleh was out of power, that, you know, olive branch went away. Much like every other political faction in Yemen, you know, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was trying to leverage a relationship in order to get something else that it wanted. It wasn't really looking for some sort of alliance with them, and they are strategic competitors in the space right now.
Well, the U.S. has, between 2011 and 2014, they pumped about $350 million into Yemen, and there's another 100, well, actually 200 million arms and humanitarian aid in the pipeline. And I take it, in terms of the arms, they're probably going to end up in the wrong hands, right?
Well, look, I think it's unlikely that the stuff that is currently in the pipeline is going to get to Yemen, at least the military funding. Who are you going to give it to? The Yemeni military no longer has a unitary control structure. It's not clear who's in charge. And, you know, one of the things the United States was working on with the Yemeni government the last 4 or 5 years was trying to get all of the various factions within the Yemeni military, which served, you know, largely tribal or factional or other political patronage interests, to sort of come together and say, okay, we are one unit, we are one military, we serve the state of Yemen, not a particular regime or not a particular group of personalities within it. And that was going relatively well up until the breakdown in the constitutional negotiations we saw with the Houthis starting about 6 months ago, and which have culminated in this state of near civil war. But look, if you look at the money that's gone into Yemen, and I've seen these numbers, you know, both on the inside and on the outside, there was about $150 million worth of military aid that's gone in. About $75 million of that was for the Yemeni Ministry of Defense, mainly aimed at taking their old Soviet-style land army and helping it train up for counterterrorism missions. So you see things like night vision goggles, and you see things like Humvees, and you see things like ropes for jumping out of helicopters and improvements in their rifles. You saw the same thing on the Ministry of Interior side, their national security police and things like that. But that's of the 150, that's only 150 million of the 350 million that are there. 200 million of it has been humanitarian aid. It has been aid for people who have been internally displaced within their own countries by Al-Qaeda and the fighting with Al-Qaeda. It's been aid for farmers who are unable to grow crops because the water tables have fallen so low across Yemen. So on balance, there's been more money on the humanitarian side than there's been on the military side.
But in terms of, though, the countries, I mean, first of all, my understanding of the country is that everybody has a gun and a dagger. Is that right?
Right, yes. Well, everyone has a gun. Look, there's 27 million people in Yemen and 9.9 million small arms. Mm-hmm. The countries in the world that have a similar ratio of population to small arms that are equally high are Finland and the United States. Mm-hmm. So having access to a weapon is not necessarily a problem in Yemen. The question then becomes, is the weapon any good, right? As for the dagger, you know, I've got a jambiya sitting here in my office in Georgetown. It's a ceremonial item. Nobody goes and stabs or slices one another with that. Men use it to show what tribe they're from. It's sort of a status symbol. Depending on how it's shaped, it'll show whether you're a tribal leader or a religious leader or perhaps an Islamic judge. So don't make a big deal out of the dagger. Make a big deal out of the large proliferation of small arms and a very large segment of the society that's under age 35, underemployed or not employed, and in most cases unmarried. If you put those sort of factors together, a large male youth population that's not employed and not married, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Yemen or China or Detroit, you're going to have instability. And that's just a common characteristic across not just, you know, the Middle East, but across the entire human family.
Well, in terms of what can be done, which is the original question, Christopher Swift, I mean, I recall back, what was it, in the 50s and 60s, that Egypt invaded militarily, and it was a long and costly and futile war. So what is the possibility then of the country? You know, I can't imagine the Houthis will hold on to the whole country. And you say the socialists, there's the vestiges of the socialist South still. Mm-hmm. How do you see this place ending up?
Well, look, Yemen, before the Houthis came in and sort of unseated the current government, was in a state of dysfunctional equilibrium, which is to say there was a balance between the various factions and groups. And that balance, you know, was more or less steady from 1 year to the next, notwithstanding the fact that nobody could make any fundamental improvements in the society in terms of the economy, governance, human rights, security, any of the things that Yemenis and outsiders who care about Yemenis might care about. Where they are now is they've moved from this situation of dysfunctional equilibrium into a situation that looks like dysfunctional disequilibrium. And that means a high likelihood of civil war. That means a high likelihood of various regions or various tribal confederations, you know, consolidating around their own communities rather than stitching the rest of Yemeni society back together. And so it is conceivable that you could see various pockets of interest or areas of control arise across Yemen, with Sana'a, the capital, sort of being the contested point, much like Sarajevo was a contested point in Bosnia during the Yugoslav War. But look, the thing that's difficult here is the Houthis don't want to govern Yemen. What they want is to ensure that nobody else governs Yemen, and that's a very complicated situation. Usually when someone unseats a government and takes over a national capital, their goal is that they will secede them and be the source of power. Well, with the Houthis, they're sort of ambivalent about controlling all of Yemen. What they really care about is their particular constituency, the autonomy that they want in their particular region. And to the extent that other groups in the country do that, you could see a breakup of Yemen de facto, even though no one's going to recognize more than one Yemen in the near term. One quick point about the socialists. To the extent that the former PDRY leadership has come back into southern Yemen, they've come back in with a lot of money, a lot of backing from some friends in the Gulf, but they have absolutely no street cred, for lack of a better term, outside their own villas on the seashore. So the notion that that particular group of people is going to do anything other than fund, propaganda campaigns or be involved in national level politics in the capital is sort of laughable. They don't really know the people that they claim to govern or hope to govern. It's sort of an interesting disconnect, a different kind of elite trying to figure out how to impose its interests and will on others.
Well, Christopher Swift, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Good to be with you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Swift, who's a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia's Center for National Security Law. His forthcoming book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the latest plans by Republicans to cut food stamps. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Wild, who's the president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund, and he litigated major law reform and class action cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, and food stamps. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Wild.
Thank you, Ian.
And the Republicans apparently are preparing, starting on February the 25th at the House, before the House Agriculture Committee, they're holding hearings to try and cut food stamps again. They tried to do that recently. They tried to cut $40 billion out of the program back in 2013, and they came up with a compromise. What more is there to cut? I don't understand this compulsion. And the leading proponent is the committee chairman, Mike Conaway, who's talking about people who work hard and built America and a family that depends on their own work is more secure and that there's dignity in taking care of yourself. The assumption being that I guess these people on food stamps are all freeloaders.
Well, I think there's some of that rhetoric floating around. On the other hand, just to be optimistic for a second, the chairman and the Republican leadership haven't yet committed to trying to cut food stamps. There's some loose talk about it, and it's certainly a distinct possibility. But I think there's still hope that the members of Congress will come to their senses and recognize how crucially important this program is to everybody in the program. Some of the conversation about tougher work rules is inconsistent with the facts of the program, which is that, and with the facts of the economy, which is that, of course, we still have serious job shortage problems in the country. There are millions of people on the program who are working, but whose wages are so low that they need food stamp help to have enough to eat each month. If you look at the population in the program, the vast, vast majority of people in the program are either seniors or children or people with disabilities or adults who are working.
And that's about close to 50 million people.
There are about 46 million people who receive benefits right now, each month in an average month. About half of them are children. And millions more seniors, people with disabilities. And then, you know, among the working-age adults without disabilities, which is a modest proportion of the population, about 40% of them are working.
So what do you understand, since you work on the Hill and obviously you work trying to get the Republican lawmakers not to cut food stamps, or at least make arguments why they shouldn't? Have you figured out what is this compulsion, though? And they've been accused, by a lot of the Democrats, like Jim McGovern, for wanting to balance the budget on the back of the poor. And we know that, for example, one of the more outspoken Republicans, Representative Stephen Fincher, he even quoted the Bible in the last debate to cut food stamps, saying, "The one who is unwilling to work shall not eat." And this guy, Stephen Fincher, is one of the biggest recipients of farm subsidies, which is a form of welfare, for wealthy people. So I don't understand that compulsion. If you look at the whole federal budget, you look at the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter that doesn't even work, and the trillions that are being thrown at that, you just wonder why go after the poor?
Right. Well, I think not that I'm sympathetic to this. But there are a lot of Republicans, a lot of members, not all, a lot of members on the Republican side who see the path to a smaller government as running through cuts to low-income programs. That's not just food stamps, but Medicaid and the Earned Income Tax Credit and other programs that low-income people make need so badly. And, of course, the harm in that is that the economy, and this goes back 30, 40 years now, wages for low-income working people have been falling compared to inflation for 30, 35 years now. So people, particularly those with less education, are making much less than their parents did. And so these support programs, and also they're not getting health insurance at work anymore. So these crucial safety net programs, like food stamps, like Medicaid, like the Earned Income Tax Credit, are what's helping families get by and meet the very basic essentials in life. So I'm not an expert on biblical verses, but I believe there are a lot more biblical verses about our duty to help those who are in need than there are that Representative Fincher can quote.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Wilde, who's president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund, and he litigated major law reform and class action cases in the Federal Courts of Appeals and Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, and food stamps. So what's your sense, though, of some of the Republican think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, who are not necessarily suggesting that they go along with the wholesale cutting of food stamps, but they think it's and this suggestion has come from other quarters, that we ought to be looking into more of exactly what kind of food the USDA is you know, encouraging or allowing in terms of food stamps. You know, they won't, of course, liquor and tobacco and other things are banned. But on the other hand, you can't get them on food stamps. But what about the nutritional side of it? It's 'cause
so sure. So you know, as you say, you can't buy paper towels and other non-food items or liquor in the program, but essentially you can buy any food. And the evidence is pretty clear that within the constraints of the inadequate amount of benefits that food stamps are, that food stamp recipients and low-income people generally are making, you know, essentially the same food choices that everybody else in the society makes. They're spending the same percentage of their budgets on fruits and vegetables, for example. Now, that's not to say diets are fabulous. They're not fabulous for any income level in this country. But the way to deal with that is not to crack down on food stamp recipients. And also, the problem that food stamp recipients have that other people don't have is that benefits are really not adequate to get them through the month with a healthy diet. So people run out of food stamp benefits in the third or fourth week of the month. Also, they don't have the same access to reasonably priced stores with good stock of fruits and vegetables and so forth. So, you know, the answer to meeting the basic income and nutritional needs of low-income people in this country, and again, that's, you know, working poor people, it's kids, it's seniors, it's people with disabilities. The answer is to make these programs a better form of help, not a worse form of help.
Well, again, I'm puzzled by this compulsion on the part of a lot of Republican lawmakers to make the assumption that somehow these people are freeloaders. They also suggest that, in fact, Governor Scott Walker, who's running for president, is now talking about, and a lot of Republican governors have also talked about the idea of doing drug tests on recipients of food stamps, as though somehow the money's ending up feeding drug habits. And a lot of that seems to be a subtext for, you know, sort of poor African-American communities. And my understanding is that the biggest group of recipients of food stamps are actually white.
Right. And also, of course, all the evidence is that the incidence of drug abuse is the same or higher among more affluent populations. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is a diversion from the real issues, which is inadequate wages, inadequate support programs. You know, the Wall Street Journal is covering the story of these bad ideas to cut back on the program and not covering the stories of good bills that have been introduced in Congress, for example, to make benefits more adequate, to make the food stamp monthly allotment meet the actual amount that the government says is necessary, the so-called low-cost food plan. You know, there are ways to make these programs better, and we need to make the debate about those.
Right, but the people in control of the Congress are the ones that are talking about these draconian cuts. And the people who are proposing a better way to provide nutrition and help to poor people don't have the votes. And I think the Wall Street Journal is doing a public service by at least alerting us to the intentions of these people on the Republican side of the Congress who want to do this kind of stuff, you know?
I wouldn't necessarily go that far.
Get the impression that they were endorsing this stuff.
But, right. Well, I think in some ways they provoke it too.
Right.
But It's true that, there's conservative control of Congress. And the other question here, of course, is whether the president and the Democrats will fight to keep the strengths of this program, which, well, they should, and to protect beneficiaries. The president's been very good in the last few years when push came to shove in budget negotiations in protecting this food stamp program, which is now called the SNAP program. And we certainly hope and expect he'll do the same this year.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jim Weil.
Well, thanks, Ian, for covering the story.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Weil, who's president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund, and he litigated major law reform and class action cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, and food stamps. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking to a veteran CA officer who's a former station chief in Islamabad.
The king eats another mouthful of soil. You need a full stomach to go and drill for oil. They want you lost in your own fear.
I'm at home in the streets of Rome, or just hanging around old Shanghai. Danger is my logo, espionage and go-go, I'm just digging this American crime. Two deadly agents of awakened persuasion tried to send me on a permanent vacation. I gave them the slip.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Grenier, who's a highly decorated 27-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service, a Middle East expert. He has been Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He organized the CIA's Counterproliferations Division and headed the CIA's basic training facility, the FARM. From 1999 to 2002, he was CIA Station Chief in Islamabad, then Director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, responsible for all CIA counterterrorism operations around the globe. Currently, he's chairman of ERG Partners, a consulting firm to businesses in the intelligence and security sector. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Grenier.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
And this tragic shooting of three Muslim students in North Carolina, it seems to highlight, and of course we don't know whether it was a hate crime or just a dispute over parking, but it sort of highlights a notion that I, at least, and some have, that in this so-called war on terror, our front line are really what we call moderate Muslims, and nobody is a greater exemplar of how America integrates its Muslim citizens, and these were all high achievers and wonderful young people.
Right.
And my sense is that there's absolutely no way that a Christian or a Jew could dissuade a young Islamist from becoming radical. The only people that can do that are these people that we loosely call moderate Islamists. And I think we tend to sort of alienate them and lump them in with the radicals in this broad brush. And essentially, I guess the point I'm trying to make is my sense is that these are the real people on the front line if we're going to win this so-called war on terror in terms of hearts and minds.
Well, I could not agree more, and I think that's true both at the local societal level here in this country, as you've just described it, and also more broadly in the world at large. We talk about U.S. involvement in a struggle against radical Islamic terrorism. Well, this is essentially a struggle within the Islamic world. It's a struggle among Muslims for the heart and the soul and the future of the Muslim world. And I think that those about whom we are most concerned clearly represent a very small minority. And the key to their opposition is opposition within that Muslim community, whether we're talking globally or whether we're talking locally in a little town in North Carolina. And obviously, we as a country, the West more broadly, have a big stake in the outcome of that struggle. We want to influence it to the extent that we can positively. But I think it's extremely important that in the process we don't demonize and discourage the very people on whom we all depend to be, as you say, in the forefront of that struggle. And in my own conversations with Muslims here in the United States, and I have them quite a lot, as you can imagine, most of us who are of a different background don't fully realize the extent of even inadvertent intimidation that takes place against that community, and particularly at a time when where people are legitimately, I think, concerned about homegrown terrorism, the real bulwark against people who are radicalized and want to take violent action on their own are the people among whom they are living, who don't want to see good young people go bad, and to the extent that we discourage people from coming forward with their concerns about individuals in their own community, we are only harming ourselves.
And in your new book, Robert Grenier, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA Diary, you mentioned that in effect you were present at the creation of the War on Terror. Were we wrong-footed from the beginning in the sense that we declared a war rather than to do something, quietly with intelligence and police forces around the world in the very countries where these terrorists originate from? And to the extent that people like Rumsfeld and others went on television and equated, in effect put al-Qaeda as an equal player on the world stage, instead of referring to bin Laden as a criminal, he became a jihadi, which has some kind of spiritual connotations in Islam. And in a sense, we elevated him to an equal player on the world stage instead of being some demented cave dweller.
Yeah, well, I think if we unpack all that and we look at the past history, I think we do have to remember just the shock that people in this country were in after 9/11. The extent of the damage that took place was something that was really almost unimaginable, and I hope and pray that it's something that will be very, very difficult to duplicate in future. The people who were trying to strike us were, among other things, very lucky in being able to mount such a devastating attack and not to have been discovered in the process. So I think that just the level of devastation and the shock that we experienced, I think, it shaped a lot of the reaction that you're referring to. And much of this global struggle against terrorism has, in fact, unfolded essentially as almost indistinguishably from law enforcement. In all those parts of the world, which thankfully is the majority of the world, where there are competent governments who are reasonably able to control their own territory, this is essentially police action. And much of what the CIA does and has done, even as a foreign intelligence service, has really been much more like international police work. That said, in areas of the world that are, if you will, unoccupied space, natural terrorist safe havens simply because there's no competent government authority that's able to control them, that's where the struggle takes on more of the aspect of war, properly so-called. And that's why so much of our focus is on areas like Afghanistan, the tribal areas in Pakistan, nowadays large parts of Iraq and Syria, parts of Yemen, Somalia. The reason that those are such a focus of current activity and current concern and have sort of colored our perceptions of the overall struggle is because those are the parts of the fight that are the most difficult to conduct, simply because we don't have competent or effective allies able to carry the fight on the ground.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Grenier, who's a highly decorated 27-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service. He was a Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia and was CIA Station Chief in Islamabad and is the author of the new book just out, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA Diary. But the operation in that you write about in your book, and of course it goes much further than that, but the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan after 9/11, in essence, though, it seemed to be the most successful so far in this war on terror, and nobody can claim that Iraq was a success. That's still haunting us to this day. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that one of the reasons why it was successful was that it had a very small footprint. And a part of taking bin Laden's bait, if you will, is that he was saying, you know, the Christian armies want to invade Muslim land. So is that, in essence, our problem, that we become the problem? The more boots on the ground, the more it ceases to be about whatever's happening in that country, and it becomes an issue about America.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I would have difficulty, frankly, in encapsulating it as well. One of the things that I argued for immediately after 9/11, when I was the CIA station chief in Islamabad, Pakistan, and at that time with responsibility both for Pakistan and for most of Afghanistan, all of Afghanistan that was controlled by the Taliban at the time, which is about 90% of the country. And what I argued was precisely what you've just captured, and that was that if we come in a big way with a large military force, if we are perceived in Afghanistan as invaders, then we will be resisted. And not just out of nationalism, but also out of Islamic piety. You know, we will be seen as an invading army of unbelievers against whom Muslims should put aside their differences in order to unite to resist us. And that's obviously not a place where we wanted to be. And so I made the case that we should be operating behind Afghans, that whether we're talking about the Northern Alliance that was engaged in a civil war with the Taliban up in the north, or with dissident Pashtun tribal leaders in the south, they must be the ones to take the fight to the Taliban if they are willing, and that we should be there to support them. So that in domestic political terms, this will be seen as an Afghan struggle, albeit with American involvement. And I think the one element of the strategic mistake that we made after 2005, when the Taliban was beginning to reassert itself in significant parts of Afghanistan, was that essentially we, in essence, decided that Afghanistan was too important to be left to Afghans. And rather than doing what we did at the outset, we essentially took the war over. We had 100,000 U.S. troops at the high point, with an additional 40,000 from NATO. We were spending $100 billion a year in this tiny, agrarian, primitive country. And we just overwhelmed the place. And the things that we were able to achieve in our own right in the short term, for the most part, were simply unsustainable by Afghans themselves. And so arguably we did in aiming for the perfect rather than merely the good, we did a great deal more harm than good.
So clearly you weren't listened to.
In the early days, we were listened to. What I like to refer to in the book is the First American-Afghan War, the fight that we conducted in 2001, and which we thought we won as of December 7th, 2001, when al-Qaeda and the Taliban were driven out of Kandahar at the end of the 88-day period that I refer to in the title of the book. And in looking back at that now, it seems to me that our victory in some ways was too easy. And speaking for myself as well, I didn't fully understand the reasons why we won this deceptively easy victory. Didn't really fully understand the local politics at work, particularly in the Pashtun-dominated parts of Afghanistan, and therefore didn't realize just how fragile this victory was. And eventually the Taliban was able to reassert itself, and that the way that that we, the Americans, and our Afghan allies responded to that was, as you've just suggested, it caused us to forget the principles that we'd followed in the first war. The fears that drove my advice at the beginning seemed to many to have been unfounded. We weren't going to end up like the Soviets or the British before us. But in fact, that's essentially what has happened since 2005, and we are essentially abandoning Afghanistan right now. I think we're trying to put the best face on it that we can, but it's essentially an abandonment, and the country is falling once again into civil war. And I'm very concerned about the future, when if there is a shift in the global jihad, if you will, and if those who are currently achieving victories in Iraq and Syria are reversed in the future, as I think they will be, they will once again be looking for terrorist safe havens, and I fear that they will find them in Afghanistan.
So in terms of much has been said about Pakistan, our erstwhile allies, sort of perfidious nature and the idea that we've been stabbed in the back constantly, and there's no question that the Taliban operate out of Pakistan, use it as safe haven, and that's where their arms and come from and possibly their direction. Very early in, before the U.S. invasion, there was that period of where a couple of days before the bombs fell, where I believe up to 5,000 Pakistanis were allowed to get out. How much of that, I mean, were they all ISI people?
No, I don't think that they were. And I think what you're referring to, it wasn't just before the U.S. bombs started falling, but it was a little bit later in the struggle when the Northern Alliance managed to defeat, was well in the process of defeating the Taliban up in the northern part of the country. And there were stories at the time that a significant number of Pakistanis were, in fact, you know, rescued by Pakistan using C-130 aircraft. It was my job at the time to get to the bottom of all those, and I'm not sure that I ever did get to the bottom of that whole story, but it certainly is true that there were Pakistanis who were fighting with the Taliban, including some Pakistanis who had considerable military skill. I think for the most part, these were former members of the Pakistan Army, in many cases people who were encouraged by the intelligence service to go and lend their expertise to the Taliban, but we never really had full, currently serving members of the Pakistan's army who were serving with the Taliban. But clearly, the Pakistanis were—I mean, both as a matter of overt national policy and as a in the context of their covert activities inside Afghanistan, they were supporting the Taliban. When they agreed to support us after 9/11 and provided us with bases and other support that enabled us to engage in military operations inside Afghanistan, their posture toward the Taliban became much more complicated. They were very effective in helping us against al-Qaeda, particularly members of al-Qaeda who were fleeing out of Afghanistan. We captured a lot of those people as a direct result of Pakistani assistance. But where the Taliban was concerned, the Pakistanis were always hedging their bets because they didn't have faith in the future. They were afraid that a future government in Kabul would perhaps align with the Indians against them, and they always did want to maintain at least the capability to play a Taliban card against whoever was in power in Kabul.
But how then do you explain bin Laden being in the Abbottabad, which is the sort of like being right next to West Point, you know?
Right, yeah. If you look at that as a circumstantial case, you know, it's Pakistanis certainly have a great deal of explaining to do. And yet, I do believe on the basis of all of the evidence since that the government of Pakistan did not know that bin Laden was there. And if you wind it back to the time that bin Laden, because we're talking about bin Laden and al-Qaeda as opposed to the Taliban, mm-hmm. the Pakistanis were always, they were quite unambiguous in terms of the assistance that they were able to provide us against al-Qaeda. And in those circumstances, you can imagine that bin Laden would have been the last person in the world to trust the Pakistani government and least of all their intelligence service. So I don't believe that the Pakistanis had a role in helping to secrete him inside of Pakistan. One of the concerns that I would have had at the time, if I had still been in the CIA and my advice had been sought as to whether we should go to the Pakistanis, once we had reason to believe that bin Laden was there in a compound in Abbottabad, and when the question was, well, do we bring this to the Pakistanis and try to get their assistance in arresting him, or do we mount a very dangerous, potentially disastrous operation without Pakistani knowledge or consent in the heart of their homeland, as you say, a couple of kilometers from their national academy, and try to take him out by force? I guess I there's no question in my mind I would have suggested the latter, that yes, we have to do this on our own. Not because I would have thought that the Pakistanis had been helping bin Laden from the outset. But knowing them as I do, if at some point during his stay in Abbottabad, which apparently lasted for over 5 years, they had managed to discover that he was there, I'm not at all, in fact, I'm pretty convinced that they would not have told us, simply because of the political sensitivities involved. I think they would have hoped that the sleeping dog would lie, that he would die eventually of natural causes, and they would never have to deal with the political, local political consequences of capturing this man and turning him over to the Americans. And so under those circumstances, if we had approached the Pakistanis and they had some guilty knowledge that they had known where he was for quite some time, then I don't think they would have helped us. If anything, I think they would have helped him to escape so as to avoid blame. So it, like everything else with Pakistani American relations, it's extremely, extremely complicated. But at the end of the day, just to answer your question, I don't think that they knew that he was there. And interestingly, there was a commission. Pakistanis, like us, when something disastrous happens, a great national embarrassment occurs, that they appoint a commission to look into it, and the Pakistanis did the same. And you might have thought that this would be sort of a put-up and that they would be designed to whitewash the situation. And in fact, when they were formed, it was the Pakistanis said that the results of that investigation would be divulged publicly. Well, they never did divulge those results publicly. It was a leak of that information that went to Al Jazeera and was then put out publicly. And the members of that commission were scathing in their criticism of the government of Pakistan and the army and all those who might have been concerned. And they started out halfway convinced that the government of Pakistan must have known that he was there. But in the end, they weren't able, and I think they were still suspicious at the end, but they were not able to find any evidence to indicate that, in fact, the government did know. So, again, I think a lot of people, with good justification, are going to distrust the Pakistanis on this point. But my view, for whatever that's worth, is that they never actually did know, and that they were as surprised as we were when he was ultimately discovered in Abbottabad.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Grenier, who's a highly decorated 27-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service, a Middle East expert. He has been Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, organizer of CIA's Counterproliferation Division, and head of the CIA's basic training facility, the FARM. From 1999 to 2002, he was CIA Station Chief in Islamabad, then Director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, responsible for all CIA counterterrorism operations around the globe. Currently, he is Chairman of ERG Partners, a consulting firm to businesses in the intelligence and security sector. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by half.